Beyond our time, beyond our universe, lies that damned VHS copy of Space Hunter that I lost months ago. Ugh. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who were these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, a podcast short of runtime, long of wind, narrow of taste, and wide of waistline. We are FSR's weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that hurls glaives at the dark fortress of irony. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, Lord Marshal of the Burger Kingdom, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and co-host, novelist, slash screenwriter, slash ace of the House Hunter, C. Robert Cargill.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. We're talking about one of my favorites tonight, one of my holy trilogy.
One of your holy trilogy.
Well, you know, everybody has their holy trilogy of movies, you know, that usually it's Star Wars, or you have, you know, your high school comedy fans who are fans of the, you know, the holy trilogy of John Hughes movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For me, for my money, my holy trilogy, the movies that I would watch back to back to back together were Battle Beyond the Stars, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, and this one, Krull.
Krull.
All three movies with scores by a young
James Horner. Yeah, absolutely.
And all of them sounding almost identical, but with their own flourishes that make each score its own thing. But to play, you know, played together as a trilogy of great science fiction early 80s action movies, it is really something to behold.
Truly. And before we get further into our Krull discussion, I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. And while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? I'm going to read one here really quickly that was left by Dr. Tex-Mex, who gave us a 5-star rating and said, I started with the Vampires in the 80s podcast. Loved it. Hilarious, insightful, and just cool. I will never watch the beach band scene in Lost Boys the same again. You're very welcome, Dr. Tex-Mex.
Dr. Tex-Mex.
Just ruining movies for everyone. That's what we do. I think that was the official slogan for a while. Ruining movies for everyone.
No, I don't think that was ever the slogan.
We are also available on Stitcher if you would like to find us there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. So as Cargill mentioned, today we are in fact delving into the world of Krull, which is the name of the world. I think a lot of people have probably seen this movie 4 or 5 times and think that the hero's name is Krull.
No.
Everybody's name is Krull.
No. Everybody,
the weapon he throws is Krull.
Everybody thinks the weapon is Krull.
Oh. See, and that should be the one that they remember is the glaive. I mean, it's like the easiest takeaway from the movie.
Well, the hero is Corwin.
Which I'm pretty sure is the company that makes my dishwasher, Colwyn. Yeah, just what?
Is it Colwyn or Corwin?
It's Colwyn.
See, I've always wondered that. I always assumed it was Corwin, but the pronunciation of it is Colwyn.
Yeah, well, Corwin sounds almost like a real name, but Colwyn does sound like some sort of appliance company. But the basic premise here is that a traveling fortress of evil lands on a peaceful planet, and this fortress is inhabited by the Beast and his army of slayers. Now, there's a prophecy on this planet that says, it foretells of a girl of an ancient name who will become queen, she will choose a king, and together they will rule the world, and their son will rule the galaxy. The queen in question is Princess Lysa, and her chosen king is Colwyn. Again, sounding like
Corwin.
An appliance company.
I'm telling you, it's Corwin.
It's not Corwin.
No, I believe you, however... Years of watching this movie and hearing it pronounced Corwin.
That's just how you pronounce it now. But the Slayers, wouldn't you know it, they show up, they interrupt the wedding, they steal the princess, and they hope to marry her to the Beast so that he may be the one to fulfill the prophecy. And that's where our space fantasy begins.
And that's also the extent of everything you will ever see of the prophecy, because the prophecy really doesn't play into this fucking movie at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not vital to the plot. It's just sort of there as an exposition tool.
Yeah, yeah, no, it really, it's, the movie is not about, you know, them ruling the planet or their child ruling the galaxy at all. It's, it really is just kind of fluff to kind of make it seem like the adventure is much bigger than it is.
When the narrator says there is a prophecy that foretells, what he really should have just said is, the logline of this movie is this, and read it off, because that's about as much as it bears any weight on the rest of the movie. But yes, we are talking, in fact, about a space fantasy, and we talked about urban fantasy a couple weeks ago about how you have these fantastical elements that infiltrate our world. This is very much the opposite of that. So much of this movie is spent on building the world of the film and building the world of this planet on which our Dark Fortress lands. And what I kind of like about it, about the blending of styles here, is that you do have an invader from space, you have sort of laser fights going on, but all the while the planet they land on is very much a sort of chivalrous medieval type culture.
Yeah, it's a fantasy world invaded by science fiction invaders.
Yes.
It really is a full-on genre mashup in a very weird way, although the space invader that shows up is this demon. You know, the Beast, who is very fantasy driven, is just shy of being the same monster from Legend. But it at times is very fantasy, and at times it's also very science fiction. And the appearance and disappearance, the way that the fortress works, is also very fantasy, despite being this big kind of sci-fi palace with these, you know, kind of weird clone drone, weird, you know, slayer things with laser guns.
Yeah. And let me ask you this question. When did you first see this movie? Did you see it in theaters?
Yes. Yeah. I saw it when it came out in 82. I was very excited. I loved the hell out of it. I also watched it a lot on HBO after it came out afterwards. And it was one of those movies that, like Battle Beyond the Stars, was really kind of hard to find on VHS for a while in the 90s, and was one of those that I was constantly tracking down. I was trying to track down all of these movies that I loved as a kid, you know, and had a hard time. Megaforce was one which I've talked about, and Battle Beyond the Stars is another which I've talked about. And this was one of those. And finally, I found it on VHS on eBay in the early days of eBay and got it. And I'm like, oh my God, guys, I can't wait to show this to you. And showed it to a room full of people who were all like, what the fuck are we watching?
This was Cargill's Return of the Jedi. This was the third in his James Horner trilogy.
Yes. Yeah, no, this is one of the last movies that James Horner did before he kind of ascended to being one of the big guys in the 80s and did, you know, such incredible work that would then lead him on to being one of the biggest, composers of the era. And this was, you know, that early period and in the first few years when he was hungry and he was really out doing a lot of stuff, you know, up until this point, he'd done, you know, like I'd mentioned, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and he did, which came out the same year, he did Battle Beyond the Stars. He did, Humanoids from the Deep was his very first. And those scores are really good. I mean, he's really good. He does a lot of good stuff. I mean, he's doing, you know, done good stuff up to present day, but my favorites are from this era, and it's that trilogy of the soundtracks that just sound very similar and all work together, you know, married as a form of sonic trilogy, if you will.
And it's funny, the first time I saw this was on TV randomly with my dad as a kid, and I liked it okay as a kid. It didn't quite grab me the way some of the other 80s fantasy movies did, but I remember revisiting it a little bit in the early days of me living in Austin and being, again, just very, like, okay with it. It's fine, whatever. It wasn't until probably the fifth or sixth viewing that I really started to get into it and realized that I had been laboring under a misconception about the movie's iconic weapon. I'll get to that in just a minute. But first, I want to talk about that Horner score, because it wasn't until the most recent reviewing of the movie that it dawned on me that it was James Horner, and I didn't need – it's funny. When it finally did dawn on me, I didn't need the title card to tell me. I mean, you could tell from worlds away that this is a James Horner score. He uses a sort of like grandiose flurries of notes that build up into this big fanfare, and he does it so well. It's like you can almost feel the music bubbling up to a certain point, and then when it hits that big brass fanfare, you can't help but be in love with it. And, you know, hearing the first few notes, I was like, oh, this is definitely a Horner score. And it's funny because he's using in this, you know, Horner is one of those guys that his Battle Beyond the Stars score ended up getting used both in the trailers of and in other movies.
Yeah.
And what's funny about the score for...
Hell, Corman lifted it whole hog and plugged it into Sorceress.
Yes, that's true. The score for Krull actually uses entire refrains of his Wrath of Khan score.
Yes.
Just like, I'm going to move this and put it over here.
Which also is from Battle Beyond the Stars. Yeah, no, they are all so similar. Like, he's always been famous for ripping himself off.
Yeah.
And this era was the one where it was, it's, you have, if I were to sit down and play it for you and ask you which one it was, unless they were certain key sequences, unless you really, really know all three films well, you're gonna be like, oh shit, which one is this? Like Battle for the Mutara Nebula is, you know, which he does in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is its own thing and is so amazing and is probably the very best piece of music from all three of those movies. But this one has, I mean, he really captures the epic sci-fi-ness of these movies and really makes it sweeping and huge and just sound larger than life, which is kind of what Krull needs, because Krull is a weird little orphan of a movie that desperately needs love and attention from folks, because it really is something special and different and weird that just people don't connect with, and that doesn't work for everybody, but so works for me, and I know now works for you.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think the biggest strength of the movie is really that sort of mashup of sci-fi, of fantasy, and frankly, a lot of Arthurian type vibe. Like there's very much a feel in this movie as Colwyn goes out and searches for an army and an army to go out and storm the Dark Fortress. There is this feeling of like Arthur gathering his knights and you know, and each one having, even if it takes a while to kind of sift through some of their outer shortcomings, all of them having these really noble traits to them. And varying noble traits, and I really like that about it, and it feels very classic literature in that regard, even though it's a completely, you know, fantastical story.
It does, but that leads into the element that makes me love this movie. Like, as much as we've talked about the score, that was kind of get that out of the way, because that is a big centerpiece for us. But what I really love about this movie is it is a science fiction fantasy mashup of The Dirty Dozen.
And oh, yeah, it's definitely a Guys on a Mission movie.
It's a Guys on a Mission movie, but it is a Guys on the Mission movie in the vein of Dirty Dozen, in which most of these awesome characters you're going to meet at the beginning of this movie don't make it out of the fortress. Like, this movie is, you know, I've talked about this a couple times on the show, where there is this line of demarcation between 1983 and 84, where Hollywood shifted, and the idea of dark heroes and dark stories and of heroic death just kind of vanished from film. And we started getting the classic ideal of, you know, all the main characters have to make it out alive. And this is one of those last movies where we have really great characters that we really start to care about who die in really spectacularly heroic ways throughout the course of this movie, in ways we just don't get to see in movies anymore. You would not see a science fiction, you know, epic, a big budget, you know, studio film these days where they, you know, like the Avengers, where it's like, oh, by the way, by the time we get to the end, only one or two of the Avengers is going to be left. You don't see those anymore. And this was one of those last ones.
And it's funny. That's the kind of thing that it's one of my dad's pet peeves in movies, is when a big group of people is sent out to rescue one person and most of them don't make it back. He has that problem with Saving Private Ryan, which it's kind of just called to mind when you're just like, that's something I think has come back in a lot of ways, because you do see, I mean, not necessarily big sci-fi movies, but you do see, you know, in contemporary cinema now, this idea of sort of the mission above all.
Yeah.
And I think obviously
like Monuments Men is a great example of like, we're not even saving people, we're saving pieces of art and dudes are dying for it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all about the mission and about bringing this team together that, you know, for all of their faults, are really noble and heroic, and they prove it in really spectacular ways. And yeah, I think the Guys on a Mission element is interesting, because it makes a movie like Krull a great appetizer for something like Guardians of the Galaxy that is coming out. Because yeah. every trailer I see for that movie, I'm like, I don't even care necessarily about the superhero stuff. All I'm really honing in on with this is that it looks like the Dirty Dozen in space.
Except that the one thing that doesn't have me supercharged is I know that all of those characters are going to make it to the end.
Yeah.
I know we're not going, I know Rocket is not going to, you know, just barely limp out of there as Groot sacrifices himself, you know, for Rocket because they're so bonded and such friends that Groot will sacrifice him. That's not going to happen. They're all going to make it. And so I think, you know, unless
Marvel really doesn't believe the box office is going to be there, then it's just like, put them in a wood chipper. I don't give a shit.
Oh, I am. No, but you know, that's, no, Guardians of the Galaxy has this very same kind of, cool look and feel, very much that evokes what we love about Krull. I mean, Krull has, you know, so we keep mentioning this cast of guys, and they really are a great hodgepodge mashup of fantasy science fiction elements, in which we've got this young, powerful wizard who's terrible. he's just not very good at what he does, but he's got, you know, he's all about, you know, having the right idiom, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this, you know, this cool, huge, powerful, wise, but quiet, Cyclops. You've got this group of bandits. You've got Liam Neeson's as an axe-wielding barbarian.
Oh my God, you see that Liam Neeson's in Krulls?
Liam Neeson's in Krulls!
Krulls is amazing because of Liam Neeson's. He's got that braid, yo, he's got that Jedi braid!
And that's one of the rare movies where you really get to see just how big Liam Neeson is compared to everyone else, because he's towering over everybody. He's playing, you know, the barbarian, and it's one of his early roles, and he doesn't have a lot of lines, but every moment Liam Neeson is on screen, he's fucking Liam Neeson.
And it's funny to me that people are so quick to forget a movie like Krull or Rob Roy, even when they're talking about, you know, the Taken renaissance of the heroic Liam Neeson, and like, oh, he's like an action hero now. And it's like, well,
did you see Darkman? Because it was pretty actiony in Darkman. He kind of did one of the best superhero movies of that era.
I mean, don't get me wrong, he cries like 300% less in Taken than he does in Darkman. I'll give you that. But the point is, he's been an action hero for decades.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely at some point on another show have to talk about Darkman, because there's so many things I love about that goofy
mess. We need to do an oddball Liam Neeson's episode and just call it Oh My God Liam Neeson's. And because the thing is
just call it How About That Liam Neeson's Though.
How About That Liam Neeson's Though. Yeah, because the thing is, you know, when he started doing the action renaissance, people were like, oh, you've got, you know, an Oscar-nominated actor as an action hero. It's like, no, he was an action hero that kind of went off and did Oscar type stuff,
yeah,
and would occasionally do, you know, dramas and such because he's an actor, but most of his movies are pretty fucking actiony.
That's true. That's very true.
And Krull is where we first really get a taste of that, and he's very cool in that. And of course, then there's the, you know, the bandit king, if you will. Only the Lord Marshal has only the king and the Lord Marshal have that key.
You don't look like a Lord Marshal. What? Yeah. Torquil, believe is his name, the bandit king, the leader of the rest of the dozen. And then of course, also rounding out this band of thieves, which is unfortunate because his voice is dubbed in the movie, is Robbie Coltrane, who a lot of people probably currently know as Hagrid from the Harry Potter films. But I actually, the first thing I really remember him from are the Pierce Brosnan James Bond films mm-hmm. that he was in, GoldenEye specifically. We played sort of this Russian gangster that Bond sometimes squeezes for information. But yeah, Robbie Coltrane is a guy that's been around and been doing genre films for years.
Well, he should we talk about why he was dubbed for a moment? This is the beginning of why Krull has issues.
Yes.
Krull is not a perfect film. We love it, and I love it with all my heart, but it is not a perfect film. It does have issues, and some of those issues stem from Universal not having faith in the movie and what they were doing. And this is, I love telling this story to people because it's just one of the craziest, dumb Hollywood stories.
Story time with Cargill.
That you've ever heard. I mean, it is essentially what happened was Robbie Coltrane, as well as, I think there might be a couple other characters, but as well as the princess.
Yes, the princess for sure.
The future queen. They were dubbed because they were British actors. And I quote, American audiences won't accept British actors in fantasy films. That was the argument. That's the argument why they had to dub all these people to make them sound American, because nobody would buy Brits in fantasy films. And here we are, here we are 30 years later, and it's like, nobody would buy an American accent in a fantasy film. It's like the great example that always pops into mind is Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, which, if you've never seen Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, it is a brilliant, brilliant film. And it has one of the most amazing casts for Hamlet you have ever seen. And there's this great moment where, you know, Hamlet goes out. It's in the early in the film. He goes out because two guards have told him they've seen him, the ghost of his father. He goes out, and one of those ghosts is Jack Lemmon. And Jack Lemmon sounds straight out of Jersey and sounds so out of place trying to do these lines. Like, everyone else, even the other American actors do, you know, British accents, but not Jack Lemmon. And it sounds so out of place. And so, you know, we believe, you know, our idea of fantasy and our idea of any kind of, you know, European thing, it's American thing. If you've got someone who's Russian or you've got somebody who's Italian and you're not going to get someone from there with that accent, you get someone British, because Americans will believe a British accent is anything.
We are now living in a time where we believe that all fantasy worlds reside within the United Kingdom.
Yes.
I mean, have you noticed how many British people live in Westeros? I mean, do I really have to point that out? It's crazy.
Oh,
how many British people there are in Westeros.
In fact, one of the interesting things, as a side note, for Westeros is that they specifically picked actors with different accents to do characters from different parts of Westeros, because Westeros has all the various accents of the UK. So everyone from the north and everyone from I'm blanking on
Carth.
Yes,
Braavos.
They all have the same accent as each other, different from everyone else. Yeah, I almost had to turn in my nerd card there because I couldn't name any of the cities of Westeros.
It's not like every episode opens with a giant map to remind you or anything like that, so I can completely understand how that would slip.
Yeah, but that's usually the point where we're getting beers and everybody in the room is going, ba-da-dun, dun, da-da-da, and my wife's going, sexy cello.
It is a sexy cello.
It is a sexy cello. And
C-E-L-L-O. But no, the thing is that...
Back to Krull.
No, it is weird that they would think that, because now, between the franchises of Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, you can find the entire Royal Shakespeare Company.
Oh, yeah. Oh, even in the bad ones. You look at Seeker the Dark is Rising, where they have Ian McShane, like, spitting out this terrible, terrible, like, lines so bad explaining the world that you swear to God they cut it sharply just so you go, what the fuck am I saying?
Go back to 1981 and look at Clash of the Titans. Did they see, this is what I don't understand about this studio mentality. It's like, Clash of the Titans, Laurence Olivier is Zeus. Like, Laurence Olivier is the god of everything in that movie.
Yeah, but then he died.
And people buy it. And then you have Maggie Smith playing, Thetis. And,
hot young Maggie Smith.
Yeah, and it's like, why did you think nobody would buy this? Like, at this point, people have read plenty of Tolkien. People understand the connection between sort of the old European, the old European world and creating fantasy. Like, we don't have a lot of myths in America. Like, we just don't, we haven't been a country long enough to develop a pattern of myths as extensive and rich as those of Europe.
Yeah, early 80s Universal, mind. You hear us?
Yeah,
you
take that.
Take that, motherfuckers.
That'll show them.
Yeah, but so that is just one of the core things that they were wrestling with trying to make this movie, in trying to make this science fiction fantasy epic at a studio that had no fucking idea what it was doing with this property at all. And that it turned out as cool as it did. Despite, I believe it did not do well. I believe that box office on it was not huge. But it is one of those movies that endures throughout geekdom as a really, I got in an internet fight, 10 years ago, and I'll never forget this fight.
A fight on the internet?
I got in a fight in the early days of the internet because some guy in the Ain't It Cool News talkbacks would constantly refer, he had a catchphrase he would use, and he would be, it's not Krull or anything, when he wanted to say, well, it's not bad. And Krull was the baseline that he used for A Truly Terrible Movie. And it's like, motherfucker, no. No. I'm going to show you some bad movies, and then you're going to come back and watch Krull. You're going to beg for fucking Liam Neeson's.
He's so mad. He's starting an earthquake here in the studio. No, it's, you know, it made about $16 million off of a budget of $27 million. So no,
so it did really well.
It didn't do great. it did not make a lot of bread and mead for its various actors. But yeah, you know, I think a lot of the reason that this endures is, like we said, of sort of the mashup and the idea of the guys on a mission. But you know, when you're doing any kind of fantasy film, any kind of sci-fi film, so much of what is important about, you know, making that film iconic is to really develop the aesthetic of that world. And I fucking love, especially the look, the design of the Slayers. Love that. I mean, it's so like, it's almost something out of Eternia. Like, it's got this very like Skeletor minion type of look to it. And of course, they're the only ones walking around with lasers that they fire from the ends of staffs. And then they fire one shot, they just flip the staff over and fire again. It's such a fuck you. It's such a fuck you to this, like, sword-wielding Arthurian culture. It's just like, oh, yeah? And we got another one, so fuck you. And I love that. I love that about it. And I love the fact that they have this very distinctive distinctive may be a little bit dubious after I tell you this next part, but they have this very distinctive, like, death cry, and it's really bizarre. And what happens is they die, and then like a helmet splits open, and this little parasitic alien comes out. Like, and it turns out that death cry is actually completely cribbed from a 1976 movie called At the Earth's Core. There are these creatures called the Maiars, and that's just their shriek. They just went, oh, let's use that.
Yeah.
So it distinctive again, maybe a little dubious, but it really works. And there's this one scene where they're riding back up to the Dark Fortress with the princess, and they're all celebrating. And their celebratory cry sounds exactly like their death cry, and it's really unnerving. And it really kind of serves to make this whole fortress seem really just formidable and creepy, and I love that about it. And I think that among so many other things, just it's just about the design work of the film.
Well, and there's so much great design work from you know, from the glaive. Which, you know, that was the, come on, every kid in the fucking 80s wanted to own a glaive.
I still want to own a glaive. Are you kidding
Glaives
me?
Glaives are pretty fucking cool.
Oh,
and we'll get to that in a minute. The glaive has its own problems. There's a serious issue with the whole storyline of the glaive, but we'll get there in a moment. But the glaive design, you know, one of my favorite moments in the film is the widow's chamber.
Oh yeah.
And all
the
of
widow of the web,
the widow of the web, and all of these spiders crawling around, and these cool looking creepy ass huge spiders crawling around on webs with this widow. You know, there's so many, just so many cool character designs. You know, I love the way the Cyclops looks.
Oh yeah.
And the Fire Mares. And there's just so many really cool ideas. It's such an interesting realized fantasy that is almost a pastiche of stuff.
Oh yeah.
But no, it's a pastiche of stuff that we hadn't actually seen in movies at that point. Like, a lot of that stuff's been done better since, but at this time, you know, we hadn't seen a lot of these type of things done well.
And, you know, speaking of pastiche, I mean, we can't get out of this particular subtopic of Krull without me talking about the interior of the Dark Fortress, which is one of my favorite parts of the film.
Yes.
All the times when you have this sort of, and it's very, again, very much like Legend, where you have the beast trying to tempt, you know, the princess is like, marry me. And in fact, even a scene where it's like, here's the dress you will wear. And there's a very big deal about that dress that she will wear to be his bride, which is, again, something you see in Legend. But what I love about the interior of the Dark Fortress is it's like this weird, it has a Salvador Dali quality to it. And it reminds me of equal parts like Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, which, as it turns out, is a huge influence on Ridley Scott for Legend.
Yeah.
And the dream sequence from Hitchcock's Spellbound, which was designed by Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
It's like somebody mashed those two things up, and you really get the sense that she is inside this massive, malevolent living being.
Yeah, but then you get to the outer chambers of it, and it's all of that mashed up with Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, and with Empire Strikes Back, and it's got this very weird sci-fi quality mixing with that. No, the all of the character design and set design work on this movie, they're so cool. I mean, yeah. It's just so evocative. I mean, it really is. I mean, story be damned, just looking at it, it's so pretty and cool to look at. And for its time was really, really imaginative.
I would love to know how they created that spider, because that spider looks unlike any. I mean, it's not one big puppet. No. It has complete free range of motion. It does. I mean, it's way before the era of CG. I'm not sure.
I think it may have been really well done stop motion.
It could very well be. I mean,
that's what we had just seen that, a year or two prior with Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
Harryhausen had done all that great work.
But even with Harryhausen, there's a very distinctive, like, you can see kind of where. If you can't see where the clay seams are, then you at least recognize that that is how clay would move. And this is not a knock against Harryhausen at all. But with this spider, I can't see the clay. Like, I can't figure out how clay was, coming together to make it. It's got to be made out of something else, and then using stop motion. But man, it is just haunting, and it moves so authentically. Like, it moves exactly the way a spider would. There is nothing false about a single one of its movements, and just the painstaking effort to make sure to ensure that authenticity is mind-blowing. I love that scene so much. It's so much of what's great about this movie is just in the little details like that. And to think that this is a movie that the studio couldn't really get behind, didn't think anybody would like, and then it just, you have all of these artists just working so hard and creating something so masterful in this.
And then you have the big things that they do wrong.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem of this film lies, is that all of these details are great, but then you run into the problem of the glaive.
The problem of the glaive.
Okay. So one of the big hallmarks, and one of the things most of you who have seen Krull remember, is that part of this movie is about, this hero being told about this great weapon, the glaive, and that he has to go on the quest to get it.
Yeah, basically, I'm surprised the Lady of the Lake didn't hand it to him. It's got such an Excalibur quality to it. It's like, you literally have to travel up into this mountain, and if you are worthy, you will be able to retrieve the glaive.
From lava.
From lava.
Which was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And he pulls it out of lava, and it's the fucking glaive, and he throws it around, and it's fucking badass as a motherfucker. Holy shit, this thing's awesome. What's he going to do with it? He's going to throw it at a wall, and it's going to grind into the wall and open it up, and then he's going to throw it once at the bad guy, and the bad guy will die. Yeah. Like, that's like we spend more time getting this thing than he ever spends using it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, well, couldn't you have found something else to do that wasn't so hard to get?
I mean, can you imagine if Luke Skywalker gets the lightsaber from Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Obi-Wan's just like, no, actually, you can't use it until the end of the film. Oh, okay. And then that Star Wars would be like 50% less cool movie.
No, what it would be, it's like Star Wars, but if Obi-Wan had said, okay, your father wanted you to have something, but he put it on this thing that's going to take us 20 minutes of movie to get to, and you get it, and he's like, what do I do with it? Just hold on to it until later. And then at the end of the movie, it's like, oh no, the door closed. Quick, that lightsaber I gave you, you open it up and then go through, and there's Darth Vader, and you go, and Darth Vader dies, and it's like, oh wow, I'm sure I'm glad we took all that time.
I will say that the fallacy that I was kind of laboring under, that I cleared up with this most recent viewing, was that I had remembered that he throws it, it opens a rock, it gets stuck in a rock, and then it's the end of the movie. It does actually kill the bad guy.
Yes.
And gets stuck in the bad guy.
Yes.
So on that level, I feel like it at least accomplished something, but you're right, there's too much reserve around this glaive, and I don't know if that's a budgetary thing. Like, they couldn't afford to animate it so often that it was just like, okay, just hold on until the climax, and then we'll unleash the glaive.
Which is entirely possible. It could have been they got the script and they go, we don't have the money to have him throw this around 20 times. Like, this scene right here, it's really cool. He throws it and it hits one slayer and then goes to another and then goes through three slayers standing in a row and then curves back and then he stabs, a slayer standing behind him with one of the blades. It's awesome, but it's going to cost us $250,000. So let's just have Liam Neeson's come in with an axe. And okay, well, there's Liam Neeson's with an axe, so we know what happens. We don't even have to show them die. It's awesome. So, Liam Neeson's
with an axes.
So,
well, another thing to consider is how, as much as this is a film about warriors and their blades and swords, it's not a very violent film. It's that sort of fantasy-like violence.
Yeah.
And maybe that was another concern. I mean, the glaive is just a wheel of blades. It's a little bit difficult to mask violence when really all he's doing is throwing several knives in a row.
It's a bladerang.
Yeah, it's a bladerang. So they may have found it difficult to continue to walk that line of fantastical violence that's not quite as offensive to the sensitive. I don't know. Maybe that's what it was. It's hard to say, but there is a distinct lack of glaive for a movie that sells itself so much on the image of that glaive. It's the fucking logo of the film is the glaive.
Yeah.
And then they barely use it.
Yeah. You use it more in the video game than you use it.
Okay, I want to talk about that video game for a second, because I have played – this is – okay, I collect old school games, and the thing I'm most interested in when I collect old school games are licensed movie video games, especially the ones that just should not exist whatsoever.
You mean like Megaforce?
Like Megaforce, although Megaforce is a fun game.
It's a really cool fucking game.
Krull. Okay, so the Krull video game on the
Atari.
I
know it pisses you off.
No, actually, I will say this about it. I've played a lot of these games. And a lot of them are just fucking awful. One of the worst is actually on Atari. It's the Alien game where they just took Pac-Man and they replaced the Pac-Man with a bluer Pac-Man. It was like, oh, it's an alien trying to get you in the maze. And it's just like, fuck you, Atari. That's just lazy. However, as clunky as the Krull game is, and as maddening as I do find its final boss, I will admit that, it holds very faithful to the movie. Like, it's literally like the first level is you, like, trying to fight off the Slayers, which you will never do because they have to kidnap her for the story to continue. So you're just, like, waiting for the Slayers to take the princess, and then you're riding on a horse, one of the fire mares, and you're, like, trying to grab glaives off the ground, and then you're in the Widow's Web, and you're trying to avoid the spider and get through it. And then the last level is you throwing the glaive at the monster. It's very faithful to the movie.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many of these games I've played, and I've been like, you just wanted to use somebody else's engine. This has nothing to do with the movie. If you, for example, the Darkman game, there's a lot of shit in that Darkman game that I do not remember being in the movie at all. I'm like, what is that? Why am I here? What is going on? So at least, at the very least, the Atari Krull game is quite faithful to the movie. It very much follows the logic of the movie, which is what's important, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know why that was so important to me. But
I don't know either. But
but there you have it.
But there you have it. No, it's you know, there isn't a lot of overt violence in this movie. In fact, the violence that is there is usually against our heroes.
Yeah.
And what I think really works about this movie and why I love this movie so much is in place of the violence, they have this great character development of these guys bonding together. And by the end of the movie, the guys that walk out of the palace really have bonded together and really are compadres. They have gone through the shit and they have come out on the other side, and there's only a few of them left. But then those last few moments with the handful that make it out, so good.
Yeah.
And so well earned, and make that movie. The climax is a little, it's a little all right, but the denouement is so fantastic. It's so forgivable because you really do feel like these guys earned it, and you love seeing how that plays out. You know, when Colwyn finally tosses him the key and he unlocks him, he unlocks his manacles and he goes to throw it back. He goes, no, I'll keep it. And he goes, no, only the King and the Lord Marshal have this key. And he's like, I know. And it's like, fuck yeah, you guys are fucking awesome. And you know, you feel like they should bro fist and then rule the galaxy. And that's the end of Krull.
Bro fist was actually the weapon they were going to go with before the glaive. And then they decided on the glaive instead.
Yeah.
It's basically just a gauntlet that shoots.
It wouldn't have worked back then, because it wasn't until the early 2000s that we had developed the ultimate in weapon technology, which was the exploding bro fist.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thank God they got a weapon that worked, right? Anyway, one of my favorite moments in that regard is, you may look at this movie and think it's entirely cheesy, and just think it's kind of a campy sci-fi fantasy film, but there's one moment between Ergo and the Cyclops that always gets to me. And Ergo is played by an actor named David Battley, who most people know as Charlie Bucket's teacher from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He's a great character in this. He's sort of a wizard with delusions of, he's
Granger,
great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's just this moment where they're all riding off, and the Cyclops initially tells them, like, I can't go, you know, each to his own fate. And Ergo just turns around and says, there was no time. And it's just like, there's not a lot of pomp and circumstance around it, but there's just such a sincerity to that line. And it's like, everything he's saying right there in that moment is, I didn't get a chance to get to know you the way I wanted to, and I was really hoping we could be friends. And it's just such a understated and sweet moment that gets to me every single time.
Well, because their whole arc is really fantastic. Yeah. You know, right from the get-go, he doesn't like the Cyclops because he's terrified of him. He's a monster, and he's rude to him. And then he, you know, he realizes that, you know, the tragedy of the Cyclops. And the tragedy of the Cyclops is one of those great, like, you know, great character things that another wonderful little moment about Krull you just don't see in other places is that he, you know, they're gifted with knowledge of the future, but they're cursed with having seen their own death.
Yeah.
And he's seen his death, and he knows this is his time to die. And when he tells that to Ergo, he knows. He's like, oh shit. He's like, you're staying behind to help us, and you know you're gonna die, and you're doing it anyway. Holy shit, there was no time. And yeah, and that moment, it just hits you like a fist. It's just so well done. And that's the thing is about this movie, you know, so much of that writing is so strong and so clever, and just makes, you know, you don't watch this for the high adventure. You watch this to watch a bunch of dudes fucking, you know, go into
you might want to rephrase that. To watch a bunch of dudes fucking.
Walk into hell and know that they're not going to come back.
Yeah.
And it is just, it's one of those, it's just so good. And it's what I love about the Dirty Dozen as well. There are very few movies that really get that right. And the ones that do become movies we watch over and over again. And you watch over and over again, hoping that the guys are going to make it out this time, even though you know that is it impossible. It's not going to happen. But this is one of those movies where you don't want to see the people that die, die.
Yeah.
But they all die so well and so heroically and in ways that feel genuine. You know, they don't,
they've done their job. They've taken the time to develop these characters and make us really feel for them so that we're invested in them, so that when they perish in these heroic ways, we feel it. It's not just like a reduction of the ranks.
Yeah.
It is an actual, these are actual moments that we feel. And I think the Cyclops is just, he's one of my favorite, you know, monster characters in any film. And I love the fact that the performance comes through that makeup. And it comes through so well. And I just, I think it's a real testament to the movie how much they develop those characters and how much they really get us invested in them before they put them in peril. And then, like you said, we watch it over and over again, hoping against hope that this time somehow they will make it out alive.
Yeah. And as we're talking about that, let's talk about Ergo a little more.
Yeah.
Because he is hands down the best character in the movie.
Yes, he's this wild cartoon of sort of a almost like an early days of Merlin type character and someone who hasn't quite got the hang of his powers yet and is this kind of shyster. He calls himself Ergo the Magnificent, and I think David Batley plays that character so tremendously well.
But he's got so many great moments in the movie.
Mm.
There's that moment where he turns himself into the puppy.
Oh my god. Kills me.
For the little
time.
Boy. And the little boy knows it's not a real puppy. He wants a puppy. Ergo, one of Ergo's things that he can do is he can transform himself into various animals and creatures and such.
Which usually only happens after he threatens to turn somebody else into that animal and it backfires on
yes.
him.
Yes. But so he turns himself into a puppy, and it's such a sweet moment. Then, of course, there's the moment with the Cyclops. Then there's the moment towards the end when the kid's in danger and he turns into the tiger and gets wounded. And you're just – and it's just – oh, that moment.
It turns into Mr. Richard Parker.
Yeah. He turns into Mr. Richard Parker, and it's just it just gets you. And when you see them there lying together, it's just so heartbreaking and sweet, and it really the movie really does kind of capture that, taking, you know, these green guys and making them seasoned. And he is the pinnacle of that. The movie isn't about him, but it almost should be.
It really should.
I mean, except that if he were a protagonist, he couldn't be as deeply flawed. And I think one of what's so charming about him is just how deeply flawed he is. But that at heart, he's a good guy. And this is a hallmark of so many of these movies. I mean, that's what works so well in The Dirty Dozen, is you've got these guys who, some of which are there because of twists of fate.
Yeah.
You know, you get Jim Brown, who Jim Brown fucked some guys up because they were going to castrate him because he was black. And you're like, I got nothing against Jim Brown. And then you got, you know, people like John Cassavetes, who, you know, is, you know, just a small time hustler and was never going to amount to anything. And then you got psychopaths, and yet almost all of them get their redeeming moments. And this movie follows that to a T, where you've got these guys who are fucking bandits and thieves and cutthroats. And then they decide, we're going to fight for something bigger. We're going to fight for something better. And I'm going to die for that. And it just, it really pays off. And the entire movie is just riddled with those kinds of great adventure characters.
And I think it's worth noting that the movie isn't called Colwyn. The movie is not called The Beast. The movie is called Krull. The movie, it doesn't,
it's about something that nobody knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, it is so not focused on the hero, and so, like, all those moments are so well spread out through this entire group that I think that title is kind of a testament to that, because it's, you know, really, it's really about that journey across Krull more than it's about an individual hero or even an individual love story.
And, you know, as we've been talking about this, Colwyn, who's played by, I forget what his name is, he did not, if I remember correctly, he did not.
No, Ken Marshall did not do a lot after Krull, as it turns out. He had a pretty decent stint on, like, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but beyond that, just not, didn't do much.
The thing is that his role in this movie is entirely carried by his charisma, because he has no character at all. Like, he's, you know, he does not, he doesn't have a lot to do despite having everything to do. You know, he just kind of, you're the hero. You've got to be strong-jawed. You got to have a witty line here, a witty line there. But he's the cardboard that's surrounded by all the, you know, sugar and spices of the movie.
It doesn't speak highly of him that he is the king of this land. He is given the most powerful weapon in history, and he still needs like 10 guys to get the mission accomplished. Well, he's not an all-powerful hero. There's just not a lot to him.
But that's what's cool about this movie, is that it's not about one guy doing everything. It's about the need for a group to do things like that. And those are the type of movies we don't see much anymore. You know, we don't, you know, and I think that's why a movie like Star Trek, you know, the 2009 one, really connected with people, because even though Kirk was the hero, you know, Kirk couldn't do everything on his own, and every character had their big play to make that, you know, make that movie what it is.
The same thing with the most recent Mission Impossible.
Yes.
When those movies stop being the Ethan Hunt show, when they stop being the Tom Cruise show, they got a lot more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And they became more like Mission Impossible.
Yeah, it started with three, but four really drove that home. Every single character in four has a great moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Tom Cruise.
And this is that kind of movie. This is from the very end of that era.
This is the Ghost Protocol of sci-fi fantasy.
it really kind of is.
Yeah.
Except without the cool scene on the edge of the building.
Yeah, there was no Burj Khalifa. There was just a dark fortress.
Yeah.
You know, you work with what you got. So this week's junk food pairing, I'm getting a little bit creative and also, you know, some would say cheating. But I'm going to go with a snack that I'm dubbing the Kruller, which is basically just a Kruller, except that you basically tear them apart, pin them together so they're in the actual shape of a glaive, and then you chuck them at arranged cups of coffee until you knock all of them down, so you make a game out of it. And I'm going to caution you that you really need to make sure that you don't just fling it against the wall and it's destroyed, because what would be the point of that?
It was either that or the Krull Brame, right?
It had to be one of those two things, and it's not an impressive junk food pairing, but it's adequate.
A world apart from anything you have seen before. Krull.
And that's going to do it for this week's Junk Food Cinema. Before we go, I do want to ask you this question, Cargill. Do you remember the Krull reference in Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
I don't.
There is a moment in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where he's walking around the back lot at Warner Brothers, and he's trying to find this particular studio, and he says, excuse me, and stops this guy walking, and the guy is in, like, this incredible, like, suit of armor, and then he flips the face shield up, and he has, like, this really high falsetto voice, and he's like, gee, I don't know, do you know where this studio is? And asks what looks to be a showgirl, and it's actually a guy in drag, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's stage six, and it's like, that's the joke. But that suit of armor he's wearing is one of the knights from the beginning of this film.
Ah, nice.
It's really, and I'm like,
that's why I don't remember it.
But it's so weird. It's like, of all the movies they could and do reference in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Krull. Apparently Tim Burton's a big fan of Krull.
Or they just needed armor and said, grab something out of, and they just happened to, they're like, yeah, this is from an old fantasy movie nobody went and saw, and nobody will recognize it for like 32 years.
What's this whiskey dispensing belt doing in here? Does anyone know what this is? It's a travesty is what it is. Travesty. Those things belong in a museum. So do you, Dr. Jones. Throw them over the side. That's going to do it for this week's Junk Food Cinema. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, tell your friends about us. We would appreciate the support. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm, at massaworm, or you can find me at facebook.com/massaworm, or you can find my new urban fantasy novel, Queen of the Dark Things, wherever you buy books.
Queen of the Dark Fortress?
No.
Oh, sad. Does it at least have a glaive?
It doesn't have a glaive.
Damn it, Cargill.
I really need to put a glaive in these things.
All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Also, please do use our Amazon links. All the movies we talk about, we're going to start putting in those Amazon links at the bottom of the page there. If you click on it, if you buy that item or anything, as long as you get to Amazon via our link that supports us, we appreciate it. But for now, for Cargill, this is Brian reminding you that a glaive is a terrible thing to waste.